Hello, I am Bruce Harris.
Hi, I'm Kasia Gołębiewska.
Hello, I'm Miguel Mora, and welcome to Czechs Play.
Let's do it! Again!
Kasia, you don't know how to do this. You've been gone a couple of weeks. You remember this?
Yeah. I almost forget.
Hina Reed was trying to steal it. Hina was stealing my dance. You know, and my man Miguel, he didn't want to dance. He didn't want to dance because I challenged him. I said he doesn't have any rhythm. There's music playing.
We should invite Hina once again, and I will be dancing with her, and you will be playing.
No, you don't dance with girls. Dance with me, and dance, and Miguel will dance with Hina. So hello everybody, how's it going today? Miguel Mora, we have Kasia Gołębiewska back with us today.
Well, you still need to learn how to pronounce my surname.
I said it, that was it.
No. That's not my surname, that's another person, sorry Yes, that's the hard truth. You were just calling another person.
No. You know why I'm sitting here waiting? Because Mr. Miguel Mora tells me no, but he doesn't give me anything. How are you going to say something then tell me? Say it.
Gołębiewska.
Yeah.
Gołębiewska. Not Gołębiewska.
Exactly. Because you're saying Gołębiewska. I don't know, like, how you're saying.
That's my dialect. That's my soul brother dialect, okay? That's how we bring it, Gołębiewska. We bring it from down below. We bring it from, you know, we bring it. You know, I ain't going to tell you where we bring it from, but we bring it. All right, so change the subject. So we're back with Czechs Play Casino Podcast. We're so happy to be with everybody, and there's been a lot of interesting things going on, and the NIGA convention is happening right now. It may be over by the time this podcast is broadcast, but we have quite a few significant people that we know that are there. We wish them all the best. Hina Reed is there with Next Gen Technologies. Mm-hmm. Our Ready App guys are there. Roger Snow is there from Light and Wonder. So we wish them well. That's the NIGA stands for what, Miguel?
National Indian Gaming Association.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. That's a convention that's in Anaheim, California, Kasia, by the way. Mm-hmm. We've gotten some interesting feedback and emails since the Mike Darley podcast. And remember, we were speaking about a technology or something that we utilize in Punta Cana here, Miguel. We're talking about the multi-game designation. Mm-hmm. So someone asked, apparently we didn't really explain in detail what it was, but Kasia, what it is that a blackjack table and a baccarat table game are two different games, and they're on two different types of tables. And so something that one of my bosses, oh my God, he's one of the greatest guys in the industry, very innovative. His name is Paul Mallow. He came up with this idea to combine on one table, because they're separate games, in order to satisfy the customer who wants to play in a particular room. If that room only has a baccarat table, you would have to take the chips out of the table, take the box where the money goes, you have to take that out, and then put the new set of chips in. You have to change the computer configuration to the new game type, which would be blackjack if it was baccarat. Yeah. And that could be 45 minutes to an hour, you know?
Okay. So waiting, in fact, to do this.
Player. So in order to take care of the player right away, Paul Mallow, he came up with a concept when we were in Tampa to do everything on that one table, but flip the table top. And you don't have to take the chips off. You don't have to change the box, but he changed the game type. Instead of being a blackjack table and a baccarat table separate, he created a new game called a multi-game designation table. So
out of those two,
it'd be done in a matter of minutes.
Instead of taking between 45 minutes to an hour, that change took about, on the average, from 3 to 5 minutes tops.
Wow. And like right now, is it implemented already in like other casinos, or is it?
It is something that we did at Hard Rock that was done at the Hard Rock properties in Tampa.
So here, Casa, this is a traditional conventional table, blackjack table, right? And this is a baccarat table. It looks different, right? So what we did here on this table here, and actually these tables here, Paul Malo, this is in Hard Rock here in Punta Cana. Paul Malo is the person that ordered these tables. So now this area here, you see the cursor?
Mm-hmm.
That's a baccarat table. It actually, this part right here, you pick it up and it flips over, you sit it back down, and now it looks, it's a blackjack table. So we combined the two games. What we did, we took the theoretical of a blackjack table, we took the theoretical of a baccarat table, and we did an average of the theoretical, and we came up with a blended theoretical win. Mm-hmm. And on that configuration, now we don't have to change the computer configuration. We don't have to change the chips or nothing. So when we do the numbers, it's called a multi-game denomination game. And we know it's a high limit table. So that's how we can track the activity on that table. So
sounds like a great idea. You know,
it's a great idea.
It is.
But you mentioned that you are doing this like in a separate rooms, right? Like it's a private space.
It's mostly in the private gaming areas. Yes.
Yeah.
Because that's where those changes usually take effect.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so that's what we call the multi-game denomination table. Multi-game designation table. And that was created by Paul Malo, my hero. He's out there. So Paul Malo, if you're hearing this is a shameful plug for you, my man, because
It was a very good idea. Of course, there's always people that are going to question that because it's not their idea.
Yeah, we.
If it's not my idea, it cannot be a good idea.
Who are you talking about, Miguel? You're talking who?
No. I'm just talking people in general.
Who are you talking about, Miguel? Give me
people
the initials.
People in general, they might say that. And then especially, it's usually people who never dealt any games whatsoever.
Who are you talking about, Miguel? Who are you talking about?
Observations.
I want to know, Miguel. Tell me who you're talking
That's
about.
That's not right. It can't be right. It can be right.
There is an interesting thing for me, like, because if Paul, invented this, like, and other casinos are implementing this this table also, is it like a...
He can probably...
Or it's like, anybody can just do this because it's kind of, okay, like it's invention, but it's simple, like right after it was already done, it's pretty simple to, copy.
You have to realize one thing. If you do anything while working at a property, that becomes the property of that entity because you're getting paid to work for them. So any ideas that you come up with, and anything you develop and you put in action there while you're working there, it becomes the legal, the intellectual property of that entity. Mm-hmm. So you got no rights to it, even though you were the one who came up with the idea.
Okay. So we that was great. So guess what? Remember we had Joe Gimo. Well, this was Joe Gimo's partner. This was Joe's boss.
Oh,
this was Joe's boss, who was my boss, Miguel's boss at one time. Howard Dreitzer was the COO, corporate COO of Hard Rock. But he's in Queensland, Australia. So let's welcome him. And he's coming in right now, Howard Dreitzer. Howard Dreitzer is here with us. Let's see.
Howard, are you with us?
Howard.
Yeah, I'm there. How you doing?
Good.
Very great.
You want to activate your camera? Activate your camera.
Right. Do you need help, Howard?
No, I don't need help, Lucy.
There he is.
Hey.
Great to see you, Howard.
Good to see you. How are you doing?
Good.
Bruce,
last time we saw each other was back in New Orleans many, many years ago.
Yeah, that was a long time ago in another life.
Yeah.
What did you say, Howard? You said something very intelligent.
Miguel, is Bruce still making you do all the work?
No. Actually, he does most of the work. We just come along for the ride.
Most of it. We're supposed to have integrity in this business. You know what I mean? Casa, Colleen Buska. I mean, I'm so proud to introduce Howard Dreitzer to you. Howard, this is Kasia Golin Buska.
Hi, Kasia.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. I'm very excited.
Golin Buska.
Kasia Golin Buska. It's pretty difficult. Don't worry.
As we say in Jersey, Kasia G.
What was that? What?
Kasia G.
Kasia G, exactly. Yes, exactly. See? But don't worry, Bruce still doesn't know how to pronounce my name.
Break his stones like you break my stones. Break. Come on, let me see where's your guts at right now. So how this is interesting because we're in three different time zones, and that's why it was very difficult to communicate with the schedule. And we're supposed to click on at 8:30 your time. I'm sitting here enjoying my breakfast, or because it's like 7 a.m. in Dominican Republic. Kasia is in Valencia, Spain, which is now 1 o'clock, 1 p.m. Howard is in Queensland, Australia.
Yeah.
But 9 p.m. down there, down under.
Down under.
So, well, what was that? Was that your Australian hat on you had on during the trailer that you did?
Yeah, it's a very typical Australian hat. Yeah.
It's a Crocodile Dundee type of hat, yeah.
More like, no offense, he was one of my favorites, Jed Clampett. I loved him. He was.
You love rednecks.
Yeah, I love. Yeah, okay. So anyway, how you doing, man? So what's happening in Queensland? What are you doing? So that shot that you took was actually right in front of your house on the ocean, right? The Coral Sea.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I'm getting settled here, you know. I'm a citizen of Australia, have been for years. So basically just getting all registered and permanent, my permanent residence status set up and, buying cars, and my wife is renovating the house and on. But yeah, it's all good.
Mm-hmm. You just returned because you were traveling. I heard you were like all over in Europe, and I think you sent me some pictures from Valencia. Not Valencia. Where you were in?
I was in Portugal.
Portugal.
I spent 6 weeks in Portugal. Traveled for 5 months through Europe. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It was good. It was a little difficult in the age of COVID, but I got through it.
Which place did you like the most? Which place
in
did you
Portugal?
Like?
You mean
no, in Europe. In Europe, in general.
It's funny. My first trip to Europe was to Austria and to Kitzbühel and Salzburg. And I went back there on this trip as well. And that's up there. But actually, I would say I really developed an appreciation for Rome on this trip. We stayed in the old part of Rome, and I just had a great time there. I really enjoyed it.
I love Rome. Rome is beautiful. I stay usually in a place very close to La Fontana di Trevi, which is the old Rome area.
I was in Trastevere district, but I could walk to the Spanish Steps, and it was in an old hotel on a narrow street. It was great. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it.
Did you get
have
a
you
chance
visited,
to go?
Have you visited Poland, maybe?
No, I've been
or it wasn't I've your been plan.
I've been to Hungary and Germany, and I've been to Slovakia.
Slovakia,
not Poland yet. No,
I'm Polish. I live in Spain, but I'm Polish. Yes, yeah, that's why I asked. Maybe you were in Poland, like during your trip. Mm-hmm.
I've been to Russia, but not Poland. Mm.
Okay.
So at this stage of the game, being you're kind of semi-retired, you've been like retired before, but so are you traveling more now? Because you were in the States for a while. You were in like in Colorado and for quite some time, right?
Yeah, I was in Denver for about 3.5 years. Liked it there, but the dry climate, actually, something I thought I'd like got to me after a while. And the snow wasn't too bad, but I got to say, I prefer the sun. Mm-hmm.
Because I remember before we got together, we worked together, Kasia and Miguel, Howard and I worked together also in Florida. And I remember Howard kind of pulled me out that way before, as he's always pulling me to go somewhere. And I'm always like, nah, I don't want to go fight alligators. And I winded up going. But when we were having the conversation, you, if I recall, because you and I started writing a book project.
Oh, yeah.
Back in 2007.
Yeah.
And I remember you said the reason why you went to Florida, if I recall, but if I remember, you were retired, and Jim Allen, the chairman of Hard Rock International, reached out to you for some candidates to be a COO or something, and you were helping them, and then you said, shit, I'll take that job.
Well, initially, but it wasn't that initially. I became that after a while, but he was, table games were just getting pushed through, and he was looking for somebody that could set up table games there. And, you know, I thought that would be a pretty interesting thing to do, particularly because they needed it done really fast, as down in the beginning, right? So we, by the time we started it, from writing the regs and setting up the departments and hiring the people, from the day we started, we opened 3 months later. And I'm talking, you know, hiring thousands of people. And
that's a feat.
Equipment. I mean, it was
real fast.
It was incredible. Lightning. And then it didn't stop from there, because it rolled out to the other properties. And the one I really enjoyed, actually, was the Tampa opening, because they were very worried about the legislation being changed so that they couldn't have blackjack there. And so they wanted to keep it low key. So I came up with the idea of, we did a school offsite, and I said, well, let's have everybody, let's have the school work like the casino, you know, three shifts.
And I was there. Yep.
We did that. And then we told them, all right, let's have everybody come in uniform. You know, and we did that.
I remember that.
And you'll remember the night we came out at like 2 a.m. with a bunch of buses.
And we had the buses. Nobody knew. We didn't tell them. We said, we're going to go to the permanent site.
Exactly right. We went to the casino, walked into this casino, a huge casino in Tampa, at like 2-3 a.m.
Everybody get on the table.
Opened like 100 games at 3 a.m, which, you know, from a headcount point
of view, it was a secret.
But yeah, it was a stealth opening. I really enjoyed it.
That was your idea?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that was so cool, because we all had to keep our, we couldn't say anything. I was there in the beginning. No. I was part of the team, the pre-opening team, and I was like the third person there on table games. It was Lenny, Quinn, Bill, and myself. We got Bill Scannell, and I got there the same time, September the 3rd, because Bill and I always celebrated September 3rd, because we always was high-fiving, because we didn't think we would last to the next year. But I remember going to the class, and because I was working on the property, it was chaotic. Because we only did a tour maybe once or twice, so people didn't know where to go. And that's the whole thing about when you have that amount of people, the communication is critical. It's absolute. And then keeping it a secret between, even the pit bosses didn't know.
I'll tell you, Jim Allen didn't know. I didn't tell him on purpose.
But you guys did set up. There was somebody that did the first roll. You guys set all that stuff up. Remember the first card or something dealt? It was. I think.
No, I don't remember that. Sorry,
Howard, you opened also Atlantic City. We worked together at the Golden Nugget. What would you say the major differences between the openings in Atlantic City and what you did in Florida and Tampa mainly? Anything that catches your imagination or your mind saying, okay, we did this in Atlantic City, because Atlantic City was highly regulated, and you didn't have those type of regulations in Florida. So was it easier in Florida, or what were the differences between both jurisdictions?
Well, it was easier in Florida from a regulatory standpoint, because you know, we regulated ourselves basically through the tribal regulators, and, you know, everything was well done, but we didn't have people out there measuring signs and telling us this letter wasn't big enough and you need more $5 games and that kind of thing. But yeah, so in that aspect, Florida was easier, and New Jersey also, all the regulations were a little hard to interpret and follow, and especially mm-hmm. in the beginning. Staffing wise, it was probably easier to get staff in Florida, but still challenging logistically to get people to take the job and move down in time.
But everybody showed up, Howard, which we didn't expect, yeah, remember? Because there's a standard when you go to a new jurisdiction where there's no local casinos in the area, and they weren't any in Florida. So everyone was relocating from, you know, as far as away, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, out of the country, Puerto Rico. And so we had a built-in percentage model from other previous experiences of, you know, 40, 30% would not show. And everybody showed. Everybody showed up, which was another challenge.
Yes and no. It wasn't too bad because we knew we had, after the initial opening, we knew we were doing more openings. And so we just had
Coconut Creek was opening.
A little overstaffed till we got everything stabilized. And as you know, we moved people from one casino to the other voluntarily, but still.
No, that was unexpected. It was a challenge for people. But remember, what I think was the biggest thing with staffing as far as difference, Miguel, was that was the first property of the several that I opened that we didn't have a mandate by the legislature to hire local residents.
Yeah.
And so that was correct, Howard?
Yep. There was no mandate.
No mandate. So it was easier to staff because when we went to other, like say in Detroit and then New Orleans and places like that, we had to, you know, we targeted, if they said 80%, they expect 80%, we went 90%, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to exceed those expectations. And so also when we did like the fast track program in New Orleans, we wanted to make sure we had, you know, we checked zip codes to make sure that they were local residents because we pushed that program for local residents, you know, that gave us a good image for a future project. We want to go to new jurisdictions. We can always say, hey, this is what we did in, you know, New Orleans and Louisiana. This is what we did someplace else in Shreveport, Louisiana, and places like that. So that was fun in New Orleans, Howard. Not for you.
You didn't have
doesn't
to do
sound,
that.
Doesn't, no, that doesn't sound like.
I was on Bourbon Street, you know.
Yeah, well, I was too, but I was having way too many martinis.
Yeah, and beignets and other things, mafaladas, whatever you call them, mufaladas.
Yeah. But I had a different experience in New Orleans. I mean, I like the city, but the politics and the social thing was very rough for me. You know, the politicians are extremely corrupt.
They're politicians. They're the model politicians.
Well, they were superstars in terms of corruption. I mean, think about it. The governor went to jail. The state senator in charge of gaming regulation went to jail. You know, the governor's son was selling juice to the casinos. It was just
he was running poker games or something in the mansion, I think. In the
well, they always had poker games in there. That was really funny. I remember I picked up the paper, and the headline was, "I've been looking for that." And the story behind it was, the police had come in and found $400,000 in cash in his closet. And that was the governor's quote. I'm looking for that.
Yeah, I misplaced it.
Kasia, I'm sorry.
Hey, Bruce, like, you know, like, did I listen to this, like, correctly? Like, you were writing a book with Howard? When will you release this? I want to see.
When we finish.
Yeah, but when?
Yeah, I've thought about it a couple times. I think I'm far enough out of the business now to where I can really tell some stories. So we'll see.
Yeah, we had to stop when we got to Florida. Howard said, listen, we better stop writing because we might get in trouble. You know, we were just writing stories, you know, Roger King stories. And Howard, I got a copy of it. Want to see it? That was back That was like in 2007. Here, check this out. This was the 2007. You know, he comes from a different background and I have a different background. you know, I was Donald Trump. He was Robert Kiyosaki in. And so it says, we're two casino executives. We have, it's almost 20,000 words, Howard.
Yeah.
It says, we're two casino executives that grew up with different beginnings from different parts of the country that crossed paths early in our careers and somehow maintain relationships some 28 years later. It would be like 43 years now. The casino, the other story, illustrates how a low academic African-American gentleman with a speech impediment and another had a family that dealt with the mob made it to the top of the casino industry. This book will illustrate the doubts, the fears, and the sacrifices it took to make it in this multi-trillion dollar business.
Brilliant. I don't remember that.
I threw that in there, Howard, you know. So, no, Howard, I got, here's a, I highlighted because I knew you were coming today. So, Kasia, you were
what
right
is
on.
What is the story that you, you know, that time you couldn't put into the book and right now, you know?
Well, no, Howard.
You could reveal. Howard, I want to hear it.
Howard, read this. Read this, Howard.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, you got your glasses.
I was young, 25, traveling across country to visit my parents. When I started my trip, they were living in Los Angeles. My father, a good provider and businessman, had lost everything to organized crime, another story in itself, and believe it or not, connected in a way to Las Vegas. He was working for very little money as a security guard. By the time I reached the West, my parents had moved to Las Vegas. My father had an idea for a business there. I intended to go to school in Los Angeles to learn underwater construction. I was into diving in those days, and then I stopped in Las Vegas to spend some time with my parents.
So that's how you started, but check this out. Okay, look, read this. Remember the Nevada Club?
Yeah,
I like this part.
In the Nevada Club, I was dealing craps in the pit boss floorman every day. He told me he wanted me to throw someone out. I told him I was a craps dealer, not a security guard. He said I was whatever he wanted me to be and told me we had no security on that night. So like a good soldier, I cleared my hands and got off the game. I told him I really didn't know how to do that. He said, it's simple. Just grab him by the back of his pants and the collar of his shirt and run his head into the side of a slot machine until he stopped fighting. Then throw him through the doors onto the street. I said, I wasn't too pleased at having to do this until I looked at my future victim. It was actually someone from my youth, elementary school, who had always been a bully and victimized all the kids for their lunch money. Unbelievable. So although I didn't relish it, I did what I was asked to do. It went rather smoothly, actually, and I didn't have to put his head into the slot machine at all.
Okay, that was good.
I walked onto the floor and went to the craps table that I was assigned to. This is the men, yeah. The pit boss, a guy named Joe Soprano, looked at me funny whilst chomping his cigar, and I got a bad feeling from him. Anyway, I got on the table, and there was only one guy playing. He was thoroughly drunk and had no idea what he was doing. The boxman gave me a dirty look and said, move him out. I did, and the customer picked up the dice and rolled them. I don't recall what the number was, but when I brought the dice back to the middle, the boxman had a short stack of chips there and was gesturing to me to put them in my pocket as a tip. I asked him where they came from, and he just told me to shut up and take them. I did, mainly because I was scared, and the glares from the other two dealers weren't helping much. This went on for about 6 hours, during which time we filled two of the wooden tip boxes attached to the pit stand where my man Joe Soprano hung out. Well, I was pretty nervous by the end of my shift. Then the box man handed me a key and said, go get our tokes, tips, and bring them to the cage. I went over to the pit stand and nervously started to use the key to open the first box. It was empty. And I stood there in disbelief while very nearby my cigar chomping friend Joe Soprano said, you got a problem? I went to the other tip box, which was full. Obviously, Joe was the leader. We cashed the toke money and met at a bar across the street to split it up and have a drink. This went on for a while, but then I finally decided that this wasn't the way I wanted to work or what I was about. So I asked to go on another crew, knowing what this meant, and was assigned to a legitimate crew. Now, a little different back then.
Yeah, yeah. Those were the days. I mean, a lot of things were going on. I experienced something similar when I went to work at a place. I was working in Atlantic City, and I was kind of like a corporate employee, and they called me from Las Vegas to call in because they wanted a meeting. They wanted me to help them out in finding somebody for a job. And when I got there that night, I I says, let me take a walk around the casino and see what's happening. So I went by a craps table, and there was one guy there playing, and I decided to take a look at the game. So all of a sudden, the guy rolls the dice, throws some chips in the air, mumbles something, and the guy said, pay him. I said, whoa, I didn't hear what he said. So let me hang around. And next thing, exactly the same. The guy throws something, mumbles something, and whatever landed, he got paid. Whoa.
Yeah.
I said, man, I stood there for like an hour, witnessed this, look at my watch, look at the table number. So the next morning, I go to the meeting, and they greeted me. How you doing? Have you taken the time to look around the casino? I said, yeah, last night I did. I said, well, what did you see? I says, well, you guys are getting taken down there. I says, what do you mean? I says, you're getting robbed at a craps table. It happened at such time, table number such, roll the tapes, and you will see that the guy was getting paid every single roll, no matter what he said. And they caught him. They caught him. Right. You know, so you did the right thing. You didn't want to be there. So you just got away from that.
Well, it's a little difficult in those days, in particular in Vegas. If you fell into a situation like that, you had to be careful how you got yourself out, because you might wind up getting hurt in the parking lot. So,
What advice would you give me about going into a new organization and repurposing or retooling the existing culture?
Well, I mean, if you're going into, and I've done this a fair bit, if you're going into an existing property, you have to go in and assess everything. You have to assess the systems, and you have to assess the people. You want to give them a sense that you're not going to arbitrarily just fire people and bring in your own people. But you also want to let them know that, you know, what your operating style is and what you expect of people, and give them an opportunity to show you. The only advice that I could have given myself back then is, when somebody resists that sort of entree into the back into the organization that you're creating, especially if it's in a key position, you're better off acting on them right away and getting somebody that actually, you know, believes in what you're trying to do. I'm not saying just walk in the door and say, I don't like your face.
But you're doing it with purpose. You're doing it with purpose, not just to do for a show of power.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of happens.
Exactly. And so it's a tricky thing. You've got to keep the balance there. And people have to know that, you know, their jobs are secure, but they're not secure just because they have them. They're secure because they're performing, and they're, you know, trying to understand your philosophy and how you want to operate, and they're going along with it.
Yeah, because people get set in their ways and they get very complacent. Yeah. That's probably why, you know, they would be looking to move the needle a little bit to push that and manage people. You know, manage people in the way that will ultimately, you know, provide more productivity for the organization.
So, well, another thing too is, and this is not on the people side, it's on the technical side. I think I always did when I went into a property, was one of the first things was I would look at the theoretical equations that were used for determining comps. And it's amazing, you know, with all the controls and all the observing of everything, labor and all that, in the past anyway, very little attention was paid to that. And millions of dollars go out based on these formulas. And you know what I'm talking about is, you determine that the house advantage is this, and you take a percentage of that based on hours
average bet.
Right. And you give
decisions per hour.
And you pay, more importantly, you pay commissions on that.
Yeah.
And one property I went into that had a tremendous amount of junkets, and they were thriving. I mean, the floor looked like it was jamming all the time. But when the smoke cleared at the end of the month, when I look at the statement, I'm going like, where'd the money go? You know, we're not making any money. And so I said, you know, I need to take a look at the theoretical formulas, and I did, and they were so out of line that literally, in my view, they were criminal. I mean, it's like saying if you figure you have a 2% house advantage in blackjack, they would say you had a 4% advantage.
Okay, I was going to ask, how could they be out of line? Because there's is preset. The only way, I mean, your decisions, how long they play.
No,
and the average bet.
Preset, you know, but somebody
correct.
Sets it.
Yeah.
Somebody in management goes to somebody in IT and says, the house
set
advantage
the theoretical.
Is the house advantage, but perhaps is that. Well,
correct.
Somebody there, I believe, was in cahoots with the junket reps, and there was probably money changing hands all around. And so I just went in and immediately changed all of it, put controls in place to make sure that only certain people could do it, it'd be documented, and it was reviewed and audited and all that. And it was the funny part about the story is afterwards, I had a line of junket reps coming into my office complaining.
Hey, you caught on, you caught on the action.
Yeah, who did this?
They knew what was going on. And, you know, one guy sat there and he said, you know, you're really affecting my income. I said, let me explain something to you. What you were doing was criminal. And you're lucky you're not sitting here with the police. And you can stay.
That still goes on.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. I said, you can stay or you can go. I really don't care because at the end of the day, we weren't making any money with you. We were just spinning our wheels. We had all this action going on, but all the money was going to you and to the players, not to us. And he just kind of, it dawned on him. I said, you know, you're doing something illegal here. So don't complain to me.
Mm-hmm. Kasia, can you imagine working in an environment like that?
Well, I would say, well, yes, for sure. It's pretty challenging. I don't know, like, well, it has, it's, well, entertaining, but challenging, definitely.
How we're talking about those types of illegalities and weird stuff. You know, you've been all over. You've been around many properties and many jurisdictions. Anything that sticks out in your mind that, aside from that example that you just gave us, could be construed as something of that sort.
In terms of institutional stuff, or you. No, I mean, most of the time, other than that particular instance, most of the time it's petty stuff. There'd be a floorman pumping up readings, you know, so that players could get comps, or a pit boss doing it. Collusion with staff was a big problem at times. There was one incident that I was around that I think even surveillance was involved in. Because the incident was a cold deck that went in at this property. And it went in at the exact time that this is back when surveillance was all on tapes. And it went in at the exact time all the tapes were being changed. So there was no footage.
Wow.
I thought that was a bit odd. But once again, it's collusion.
Yeah.
And I know one property I went to, the owner was paranoid that everybody was stealing from him. And when I got there, he was right. Everybody was stealing from him. I mean, the front desk, the cage, I mean, everybody. So, I mean, there's lots of opportunity in a cash business for theft and delusion and misrepresentation. But I got to say, the one with the theoreticals was probably the scariest one, because it's silent. It's, you know, nobody has to do anything.
Correct. Yeah.
But you know, the thing is that what gets me, Howard, and as long as, you know, we've been in the industry, I could say that, you know, I was fortunate enough to work with people of high integrity, because that's the only thing that we have of value as individuals.
Absolutely.
Workers with our positions, especially when you're in the position of decision making with the company assets. And I've been fortunate, but it stands out like you would not believe when you see something of the opposite with regards to the lack of character or integrity. And exactly what you just said, I've seen where a senior VP of an organization, corporate position, goes in and changes the theoreticals when a certain group of players come in and has IT, hey, we're going to change it to this, and does it in a way they think that nobody knows but them, what they're doing, because they're so full of themselves to think that everybody's, you know, licking the heels of their shoes because that person, you know, that feels like they're, everyone's looking up to them, that they're golden.
I just recalled one as we were talking that was kind of humorous in a strange sort of way. This one property I was at, we were doing a lot of South American business, junkets, big players. This is in the mid-80s. And I get a request from this player development executive, senior VP, whatever, to give this guy a $250,000 line. So, okay. I need some bank information and this and that. So about an hour later, I get faxed to me bank information. But I look at the top of the fax and it came from inside the casino, not from South America or a bank even, but from inside the casino. I'm looking at it and going like, that came from our offices. So I traced down the number and it was this guy's, the fax machine that he used. So he dummied up this credit app, bank information, and then faxed it to me and said, hey, there you go. Go ahead and give him the line. So I got upset about it, obviously. And I called the president of the property up. I said, we got to have a meeting with this guy. So he calls us in, right? And this guy was very productive for us. It's just that he didn't believe he was accountable. And we're sitting there and I tell him, you know, I said, look, I mean, you dummied up this report and sent it to me. You can't be doing that stuff. I'm making $250,000 decision based on this thing. You know, it's got to be legitimate. Mm-hmm. And he goes, are you accusing me of lying? And I look at him and said, you are lying.
It's right here. It's right here.
Right.
Here's the problem. You lied. He says, you're impugning my integrity. I said, you impugn your integrity. I didn't do it. It's incredible. You know,
and for the people that are listening out there that may not know, when we mentioned, you know, with all due respect, Howard, there may be people that don't understand the theoretical part, you know, and about the formulas. Just to be clear so everyone knows, when you talk about theoretical, what that means is the casino operation pays a customer or a junket rep or whatever rewards, paybacks, you know, reinvestment, a percentage of those, that theoretical, which is really the what we saw, qualified bankroll, the person, what their betting strategy is what they're actually worth, is that's how we measure them. So when you're talking about pumping up a theoretical, now that means the company will pay out, and some of this is hard costs. It might be airfares. It's rooms, which is not hard. It's a soft cost, but when you're talking about private jets and things, Miguel, you can really get into that.
Well, that's your airfare area. And commissions, as Howard said, it's a big chunk of money that is hard cash going out the door.
Discounts
also. So those are the three major factors: the airfares, the commissions, and the discounts. The rest, as you say, are soft costs: rooms, food and beverage. That's soft costs. It costs money still, but it's not of such a big variant as the other one. So we have to protect those assets within the company, and we have to watch those. Because remember, sometimes the player development executive he wants to produce business. And if there is a junket program going through him, he wants to take care of the junket rep. And the junket rep is there to make money. He doesn't care whether the casino wins or lose or what is done, as long as at the end of the month, I get a big fat check. So it's up to us and people like Howard, when they're in charge of the operation, to meticulously watch those costs and keep them in line.
Because that can make or break.
Of course.
That can make and break your P&L, which is a profit and loss, whether that event, if it's an event and you brought players in, when it comes down to how much did you spend and how much did you actually win, you can come up at a loss because of how much you had to pay out all of those different costs. So that's why when we say theoretical, for like I said, for the folks that may not understand what that is, you know, for the layman, that's basically why that is so important.
Yep. Very much so. Very much so.
Howard, what's the situation you ever had that could have gotten you to a jam, when you could have gotten jammed up because of a decision that you made? Something that could have cost you your first, middle, and last name, at least.
I did get jammed up. It was 1980.